absolutely part of our heritage and part of our tradition and part of what make us as a community who we are today, and we are not told those stories.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to a podcast from the room behind the bookcase.
So hello and welcome to the room behind the bookcase, and today I'm recording in a wonderful little study in Dronfield, and I'm joined by lecturer in creative writing, editor of the Storylines magazine, singer-songwriter, piece worker and storyteller extraordinaire, Simon Haywood. Simon, hello.
Hello. Hello,
Tim. And the reason why I wanted to speak to Simon on this show is that in 2014, possibly the most moving piece of storytelling that I heard, that I got a chance to go on and see, was Out of the Silence, the commission for Beyond the Border. And I'm really glad to see that that show is going on, you're getting a chance to tour it, that it's still being booked. And I really wanted to, because it's quite an unusual piece, I really wanted to have a chance to talk to you about that show and what went into it. So what is Out of the Silence?
Out of the Silence is a storytelling piece, a number of stories that are based on the memoirs, the letters and the lives and adventures of a number of conscientious objectors in the First World War. It was commissioned by the Beyond the Border International Storytelling Festival in last year, in 2014, for the centenary of the First World War. And what they wanted was to look at the stories of the Conchies as a way of commemorating the outbreak of the war that was slightly away from the obvious. And I got the commission. And I went to, any sources that I could find, really, but primarily to the memoirs and the letters of Quakers, Quaker conscientious objectors, who had a family connection to Sheffield and whose books and whose papers were lodged in the library at the Quaker meeting house in the middle of Sheffield, and also by talking to their family members who are still around. And I put together a sense of their stories and their lives, and I went and looked at those in the context of the way that the war was developing, and basically we got some stories out of it. And there's about half a dozen figures, maybe half a dozen individual conscientious objectors. We tried to get as representative a spread as possible, but you couldn't do that. There were thousands of these fellas, so trying to boil it down into stories that you can tell in the space of 60 minutes or 90 minutes is an impossible task. So we had to be very selective, but we managed to get maybe sort of five or six whose experiences seem to cover most of the major issues that the Conchies faced. And we just tell the story of what they did, try and tell the story of why they did it, and what happened to them as a result. And some astonishing stories of courage, some astonishing stories of suffering and endurance, some tragic elements by all means, but also very heartening elements, because there was a tremendous amount of courage, as I say, of solidarity, of willingness to endure, and of a desire to do good in a horrible situation. A lot of which is not really very widely remembered now.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you've given it this title, Out of the Silence, and I was going to ask what it was that you felt that title related to.
Well, it was that, really. I mean, it struck me that the stories of the conscientious objectors are not widely known. I mean, I've done some work in the peace movement, so I was vaguely aware of this as an issue. And I've worked with peace campaigns over the years on and off. And I'm aware, for example, that there's a memorial to the conscientious objectors in Tavistock Square in London, but it's tucked away in a corner. And it's the square in London where there's a statue of Gandhi. And there in the corner of that square, you'll see there's a memorial to the conscientious objectors. And I know it's there, but and even I find myself walking past it sometimes because it's so small and so understated. And if you compare it with something like the monument to the animals killed in warfare, which is bang slap in the middle of Park Lane and cost about £2 million and is gilded and is unmissable, And there's a definite sense that the story is not told, that people, and this is a reaction that we get from the people who come and listen to the stories, is very often they just have no idea of what these men did and what they suffered. There was one, we did it in Huddersfield, and a woman came up in the interval, and she had actually had one of the conscientious objectors who features in the stories, a man by the name of Bert Brocklesby. Mm. And after the war, Bert had gone to work as a school teacher, and he had been her school teacher, so she had known him very well, and she regarded him as this amazing guy. And he gave her a Bible, which she still had, and she was, you know, still speaking extremely highly of him. And yet she had no idea what he'd done. What he did in the war was hair-raising
stuff. Well, let's have a little bit of Bert Brocklesby's story, okay, if you can tell that. Yeah, that'd be great to hear it.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. Well, he was from Conisbury in South Yorkshire, and he was a school teacher, I think, from the get-go, but he had a brother whose name was Phil, and they were the very best of friends. And they were on a cycling holiday when war broke out in August 1914. And the first thing that they did was Phil went straight back and enlisted, and Bert didn't. And so everybody in Conisbrough was wondering when Bert was going to go and follow his brother. And in the course of time, it came around to Bert's turn to preach to the local Methodist chapel, and he stood up and delivered a sermon, which, by all accounts, went roughly along the lines of this. I understand, he says, that you're all waiting to know when I'm going to go and follow our Phil, and I'm not, as I was not put on this earth by the Creator God to go around killing my fellow creatures. Phil and I have discussed this, and we've settled our differences, and we've agreed to differ. And then he announced the hymn and tried to go on with the service. And from that point onwards, you know, everybody thought that when conscription came in 1916, which they clearly saw that it would, then Bert would have to go. But he refused to go. He still wouldn't go. And so in the end, he was arrested, and he was imprisoned under Richmond Castle, which was at that point the headquarters of the non-combatant corps, which is where he would have, the army's unit that he would have been serving in if he'd agreed to serve. And he was in the cells underneath Richmond Castle, and he would doodle on the walls, and you can still see the doodles on the walls that he did with a stump of pencil. He did a portrait of his fiancée, whose name was Annie, and he did a little calendar with all the dates crossed off. And he might well have spent the rest of the war doodling on the walls of the cells below Richmond Castle, but for the fact that in the first rush of conscientious objection, but what happened was they put in this exemption, the conscience exemption into the Military Service Act, not expecting that anybody would take it up. They thought they'd get half a dozen Christians and churchgoers and men who wouldn't have been any good at the front anyway, you know, close quotes. And what they actually got was all those plus trade unionists and socialists by the thousand. And they were swamped. They didn't know what to do with them. And there was a kind of panic among the powers that be. And so General Haig, out at Boulogne, took the soldiers' response to this and decided that the best thing that he could do was to make an example of the few of them in order to scare the rest of them into the army. So he had 30-odd of these fellas shipped out, including Bert Brocklesby, literally in chains. He put them on, he chained them up and put them on a train to Boulogne. Because what he thought was that if they refused an order while they were conscripts in England, then they could be sent to prison. But if they refused an order while they were conscripts at the front, he could have them shot. So he wanted to get them to the front as quickly as possible. But he knew that if he was going to do it, he was going to have to do it very quickly, because if Parliament found out and Prime Minister Asquith found out, then they would put a stop to it. So it was a race against time. So he had all these fellas put on, and they were all going down on the train in chains to Boulogne. And one of them had somehow had the presence of mind to scribble a note and throw it out the window. And that was the only way that anybody knew that this was happening to them. Haig was keeping it a secret. And the note was addressed to the offices of the No Conscription Fellowship in London. And it landed on the tracks, and it was picked up by a railway worker. And because this was England in 1914, and because it was a sealed and addressed envelope, he just put it in a post box and didn't think any more about it. And it went straight through the mails as far as the desk of the chairman of the No Conscription Fellowship, who was a Labour politician by the name of Archibald Fenner Brockway, who happened to be a personal friend of the Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith. And so Fenner Brockway read this hand-scribbled pencil note, took it straight to Asquith, and Asquith telegrammed to Haig in Boulogne, telling him that these men were not to be harmed. And the telegram, he picked up the telegram and he put it on his desk and he told nobody about it, and it sat there unnoticed for weeks on end. Meanwhile, the telegram and the train chased each other across the channel. Telegram got there first, the train came in afterwards. The 50 men were dragged off the train onto the parade ground at Boulogne. And this is not a word of a lie. Somehow word must have got out, because somehow Phil, the brother who was in uniform, had heard that Bert was on his way over to France. And he'd somehow managed to wangle a couple of days leave and had made it to Boulogne. And so the first man in uniform that Bert Brocklesby saw when he was dragged out onto the parade ground at Boulogne was his brother Phil. And they looked at each other, and Phil wrote home. His letter home describing this encounter is nothing but pride. He said he was proud of his brother. And the 34, I think it was 34 of them, were marched onto the parade ground. Well, they weren't marched. You never marched a conscientious objector. If they marched, they were obeying orders, and that would undermine their case. So they used to slouch everywhere.
You do a very good slouch on the
the conscious slouch. Yeah, yeah, I can't. Unfortunately, we can't do it on audio.
No. Podcasting.
Yeah, you can't really put it on a podcast. But anyway, the 30 odd fellows were slouched onto the parade ground at Boulogne and then given an order, and which they refused naturally, and then they were handed over to the tender mercies of the sergeant majors, and they were stripped naked, doused in cold water, left on the parade ground under the frost all night. They were tied up to fences and gun carriages for 6, 7, 8 hours a day and left. And my grandfather, both my grandfathers were in the army in the First War. And one of them says, and I don't know if he saw it himself or if he was reporting something that he'd heard, but one of them said that they were strung up and left where the Germans could take pot shots at them. What definitely did happen is that they were tied up and dragged around over rusty nails, duck boards, trenches, until their skin was ripped off their back, basically. And then they were dumped in these barracks at the end of the day, of each day, and left for 3 weeks. And for 3 weeks, they refused to obey a single order that they were given. And at the end of 3 weeks, that telegram was still sat on General Haig's desk at Boulogne. And it's my belief, and I say this when I'm telling the story, it's my belief that if Haig had had the courage of the men that he was trying to break, if he had had the courage to disobey an order when he thought it was wrong, then he would have left that telegram on his desk and had the men shot and taken the consequences. But he didn't have the courage to do that. And so he had the 34 slouched out onto the parade ground at Boulogne a second time, and he called them forth one by one by name, and each one he had read out a sentence of death. And then he left a long pause, commuted to 10 years hard labour. Each one of the 34 of them, and then they were chained up again, put on a train and sent back to England. And Bert went back with the others, and he was in Maidstone jail for the rest of the war. And Phil continued to serve in the army, and he went over the top in the Battle of the Somme and was wounded badly enough for him to be sent home. And the first thing that he did when he got back to England was go straight to Maidstone jail and visit his brother Bert. And they remained friends throughout the war, and through everything that followed, they remained good friends for the rest of their lives. And that is just one of the stories.
Yeah, it's fabulous, isn't it? I mean, I think
that you found.
I guess one of the things that struck me hearing the full piece was the idea that when the war ended, that meant very little to the conscientious objector. They were all in prison, and the war ended, and actually they were still in prison.
A lot of them were still in prison. If you look at the history, basically the 3/4 of the men who had a conscientious objection or declared a conscientious objection ended up in an outfit known as the non-combatant corps. So they were basically in uniform at the front in the army, but they did the non-fighting bits of army work. And they came, as you can imagine, for a great deal of abuse from all sides, I suppose, really. But they were known as the NCC, which was the No Courage Corps, etc., etc., etc. That was probably the lot of 3 out of every 4 conscientious objectors. What Out of the Silence deals with is the other 25%, the ones who couldn't or wouldn't go into the NCC, and really the government didn't know what to do with them. So mainly what they did was send them to civil prisons and have them locked up if they absolutely refused to do any kind of... I mean, very often it was difficult to find alternative work for them to do. So they were sent out to quarries to dig. They were sent down. They were sent to work centres, where there very often wasn't a great deal of actual practical work for them to do. But the ones who refused to even do that, who believed that any form of collaboration with the war effort was a betrayal of basic principles, they were the ones who tended to go to prison. And they were still in prison at the end of the war, and with no date of release. And they generally, the last of them got out by the summer of 1919. But again, the thing is, it was the same with the soldiers. They didn't know when they were going to get demobbed either. And one of the amazing stories that we've picked up, among the many stories that we've picked up from people coming to talk to us after we've told the stories in Out of the Silence, there was a guy whose grandfather was a fellow called Ernest, who was in the army and stationed at the end of the war in a depot near Southport. And he organised a strike among his comrades because they were waiting for a demob date. And of course, in 1918-19, the fear, if you were in uniform, was that you were going to be sent to Ireland to fight the Irish nationalists, who were then gearing up for the Irish war, the Easter Uprising, and then onwards into the Irish Civil War and the establishment of the Free State. Or you were going to be sent to Russia to fight on behalf of the Tsar, who had been deposed in 1917. So when the soldiers didn't get their demob dates, basically they'd been drafted or they'd signed up or they'd been conscripted to fight the Great War, and when the Great War was over, they wanted to know when they were going home, and they just weren't told. So there was a great deal of anxiety among the soldiers, quite well founded, I would imagine. And they started organising mutinies, and this guy Ernest basically was elected the leader of his mates, his platoon. And a general came up from London to talk to him, and he knew that if he went alone into the room with a general, anything could happen to him. He could be arrested or taken off. So what he had was, he told his friends what they were going to do, and they took their own officers hostage. And when the general arrived, they went to the general and he said, "I've told them, we've got the officers hostage," he says, "I've told them that if I'm not out of this room in 20 minutes, they're to start shooting. So you've got 20 minutes to make a deal." And the general said, "Right, in that case," he says, "can I offer you a commission in His Majesty's Armed Forces?"
Good grief.
"No," he says, "I was elected by my comrades to serve as their representative and the advocate of their interest," he says, "and that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to take a commission," he says. "What we want is a demob date. We want your guarantee that we will be demobbed by a stated date, that we will get to keep our weapons until that date, and that there will be no reprisals following from this action." And the general said, "You've got it," and they got it. And
that's amazing. And that story, not in the Out of the Silence show, so...
Well, no, and this is exactly... The thing is that the stories in Out of the Silence only scratch the surface of the total the total number of experiences, so many of which are forgotten. You know, everybody knows about the Battle of the Somme. You know, we all know about the Battle of the Somme. We all know about the Red Poppy. Not many people know about, you know, Southport Barracks in 1918. Not many people know about Bert Brocklesby.
So is that, it feels almost a superfluous question, but I think it is important to ask it. Why are these stories important to you? And why do you think it's important that they are told?
There are many answers to that question. Why do I think they're important? I think they're important mainly because, I mean, although, and I work as a storyteller, so a lot of what I say is, you have to make a good story out of things, and often when you're telling these stories, I couldn't swear that every last detail is absolutely documentary accurate to the nth degree. So, you know, it's an imaginative or a creative undertaking is storytelling. But essentially, in their essence, the stories are true. They are truths. You know, these things really happened and people really did do them. And I also note that, as again, the title is a reference to this, they are not known or celebrated. They are deliberately or accidentally forgotten and swept under the carpet. People don't know. And they don't. And every time we do the stories, somebody will come up and say, "Oh yes, my granddad was a conscientious objector." Very often, someone who knew one of the conscientious objectors in the stories, and they don't necessarily know. So there's this whole forgotten
thing going on. And it relates, I mean, I started looking at the stories, I believed, as I suppose many people believe, I had this image of the conscientious objector as a lonely soul struggling with his own private principles against a world that didn't understand or care. And actually, that was not the case. You know, the conscientious objectors by the end of the war were essentially the poster boys for a mass peace movement, and that whole peace movement does not figure in many people's understandings of what happened in the war. And everybody knows that in 1914 the war was, you know, everybody there was a great surge of enthusiasm for the war. Well, it's not quite that simple anyway, you know, because one of the things that was happening in 1914 was that there were firms in Huddersfield, for example, where the employers, particularly the employers who were in favour of the war, were working out who in their workforce was of military service age and giving them all the sack.
Wow.
So that they, and employing men who were too old to fight, so that suddenly you had all these young men who were of military age with no means of support. And of course, what was the only thing that they could do? They had to go and join the army, because it was the only job going. So the surge of enthusiasm for the war in 1914 is not as straightforward as people like to think. And anyway, it had fizzled out by 1917. Now, people tend to know that the enthusiasm for the war waned as it went on. But what they don't realise is the amount of anti-war feeling that there was. You know, there was a lot. And there was a singer, an operatic singer called Clara Butt. She was probably the Catherine Jenkins of her time. You know, she was an opera singer, but she also had a great deal of popular. She had a great popular following. In 1914, Clara Butt was singing at recruitment rallies, singing patriotic songs at recruitment rallies to try and get lads to join up. By 1917, she was singing at peace concerts in the Albert Hall, and there was a peace concert in the Albert Hall in 1917 where she sang a hymn, "Give Us Peace in Our Time, O Lord," and she sang it to a sellout audience at the Albert Hall as part of an anti-war meeting that certain other luminaries were at. And this meeting had numerous speakers. They were calling for the abolition of the monarchy. They were calling for independence for India. They were certainly calling for an end of the war. They were calling for all these things. Bertrand Russell was there, and the philosopher and the academic. And he wrote a letter to one of his friends, Lady Ottoline Morell. He was at this meeting, and he wrote home describing it. He says, "I've got to tell you about this. It's the most amazing meeting," and he described it. And at the end of it all, Clara Butt got up and sang this song and sang this hymn. And not only had they sold out the Albert Hall, for every ticket that they sold, they turned three people away. And if you Google Clara Butt, Albert Hall, 1917, "Give Us Peace in Our Time, O Lord," then you get the old reference here and there. But the thing is, you know, it was only a few months since the Russian Revolution. There was a great deal, people did believe at that time that, you know, particularly if you had a kind of leftward inclination, then people did believe that maybe we actually really were on the verge of a world without war. Maybe we actually really were on the verge of world revolution. People did think that. And people did hope that. And certainly Arthur Gardner, one of the Huddersfield socialists who was a conscientious objector, he ended up at a work camp at Dartmoor. And when he went to face his tribunal at Huddersfield Town Hall to face the government officials and declare that he was a conscientious objector, they'd been sat there for days on end and listening to one person after another come in and say that they had to stay home and look after the shop, or they had to stay home or they had a Christian and principled objection to the shedding of human blood. And Arthur Gardner, who always spent his Saturdays like preaching off a soapbox down in the centre of Huddersfield, walked into the tribunal. The place was packed, and they nearly had to cancel the hearing because everybody was pouring into Huddersfield Town Hall to hear what Arthur had to say. And so once they actually got everybody to settle down to the point where they didn't have to clear the room and they could actually go ahead with Arthur's tribunal, they asked Arthur why he thought he had a conscientious objection to the war, and he said he was against militarism. And the chairman of the tribunal looked very long and hard at Arthur down the end of his glasses, I suppose, and sort of said, "Well, young man," he says, "we are all against militarism." He says, I have as deep a hatred of militarism as any man alive," he says, "but that doesn't mean that a man can't go and serve his country." And Arthur Gardner, who was 26 years old and he worked in a factory, was a dyer's labourer, stood
directly facing the representative of His Majesty's government, and his exact words were, "I have no country. I have no quarrel with the working men of Germany." And he said, "The war is a gun with a working man at both ends." And they were absolutely flabbergasted. Flabbergasted. They had never been spoken to in this way before, and they had never guessed that anybody might make that argument. And in, to their credit, the tribunal went off into a huddle, and they came back 20 minutes later, and they actually said, "Well, Mr. Gardner, you've got a point." One thing is abidingly clear, and that is that you do genuinely have a conscientious objection to the war. So they gave him a deferral of some sort, a limited deferral, which he refused. And in the end, having made this concession, he was taken off to prison, and he was, as many were, he was, I mean, I don't think there's no need to mince words. He was tortured in prison, as many were. And in the end, he abandoned his absolute objection to the war and agreed that he would go and work at one of these work camps, and that's where he spent the rest of the war. Mm. But the point of telling the story of Arthur Gardner is that when he finally was marched to the train station to go off and to military prison, the streets of Huddersfield were lined with people singing the red flag and cheering him along. They gave him a hero send-off. Mm. And the guy who documented that most detail is a historian called Cyril Pierce, who actually came along when we did Out of the Silence in Huddersfield in the very courtroom where, wow, the conscientious objectors were tried, and that, well, that was an occasion, let me tell you. And there at the back of the courtroom was Cyril Pierce, the historian who basically wrote the book on conscientious objection in Huddersfield and pretty much proved that conscientious objection in Huddersfield was not a case of the odd man here or there having a principled objection to the war. It was a mass movement that had deep links with the labour and trade union movements, and Arthur Gardner was just the most prominent of a number of very, very committed, politicised anti-war figures. And since he wrote, and we met him, you know, Sharon Lee, my wife and partner in telling the story
about that in a bit, yes.
Yeah. She made me a gift of Cyril Pierce's book, which delighted me because I couldn't put it down once I started reading it. So Comrades in Conscience is called, if anybody wants to get hold of it. Absolutely fascinating read. But since Cyril Pierce wrote, and partly as a result of him writing, other people have gone off to look at conscientious objection in towns other than Huddersfield. And he finished with the idea that basically conscientious objection was a pretty piecemeal and patchwork affair across most of the country, except for Huddersfield, which was a hotbed of the anti-war movement. And people have tended to show since then, actually, Huddersfield wasn't unusual in that respect. The anti-war movement right the way across the country was more organised and more together and more substantial in its scope than people had realised.
And you're someone who has been involved in your own lifetime in sort of peace work and peace activism. Mm. And is there a sense among the left-wing peace activist factions of a continuous history? Or is there, or when we talk about the silence of the conscientious objectors, is it even amongst those people who politically support the same ideals that these stories are lost?
No, I don't think there is, actually. Okay. I mean, in my personal experience, it's only my experience, which is very fragmentary, really, at the end of the day. But it's my experience that no. People do not, as a rule, have any sense of being part of a very long tradition.
They don't have a sense.
They don't have a sense. No. People on the right do.
Yeah.
People who are sort of conservative in their politics have a very definite sense of being part of a long tradition. Often not as long a tradition as they think they've got, you know. They think they've got this monarchy going back to the Dark Ages, and actually most elements of the modern monarchy were probably invented in 1930. I mean, that sort of thing. But I think, in a sense, the political left, or progressive, or radical politics, whatever you want to call them, they have the opposite idea, in the sense that they have a much more ingrained and a much longer and a much richer heritage and tradition than sometimes they generally think. And, if you talk to... I talk and I work with peace activists, and some of the times when people are coming up now in their 20s and to mid to late 20s now, they don't
necessarily have much of an awareness even of the peace movement going back to the 1980s. So somebody of my age, like I'm 46, you know, so I very clearly remember reading on the news about, you know, the anti-nuclear camp at RAF Greenham Common. And but if you talk to peace workers and peace activists who weren't around at the time, they may not necessarily even have heard of Greenham Common. And I've been wandering around places with a CND t-shirt on, and I've had kids come up to me and saying, "What did CND stand for?" Just like, it's crazy. So no, I think people
forget. Interesting, yeah. I want to move on from the politics and talk about your creative process. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you did was you brought on board Shona Lee. I think officially you brought her on board as your musical director, but do you want to talk a little bit about... She's just walked in the room, so you might be able to hear her laughing in the background. Do you want to talk a little bit about that decision and about some of the inclusion of music and what that was all about?
We wanted some music. We wanted something. We wanted something to break it up. We wanted something to vary the texture. And Shona Lee and I have been working together for a very long time, and we know each other pretty well.
As you've said, you are married.
Yeah. I'm speaking in the sense of as storytellers sharing the stage together. Mm. In the public. And most of the time when we've been working together, I think probably if we've been doing stuff together, then I've been doing the music for her storytelling. And with things like the Tower of Babel, which is a piece that she did based on traditional Jewish storytelling, and we recorded. And I think there was a sense of wanting just to see how it worked the other way about, you know, because I was going to be doing the storytelling on this one. I thought, well, why not get Shona Lee in to do the music? I mean, she, you know, she sings. So we did that, really, and off she went and came back with... I mean, actually, the amount of music in Out of the Silence is not all that great. The number of minutes spent doing music rather than storytelling is not all that high, but there's two or three absolutely, you know, pitch-perfect and precise little bits of song, which don't seem to be... They're not massive compositions. They're not like symphonies, but they just absolutely kind of nail and capture particular moments, and it's beautifully...
And you do, I mean, it's the music's... doing quite important job, because yeah. This is a show where you've got, as you say, about half a dozen different stories over time. Yeah. So the music almost lets the listener kind of go, okay, let's leave Bert Brockelby for a moment, and then let's introduce someone else.
Yeah.
But there's one of things like taking popular songs of the time and changing the lyrics and...
Yeah, that was it. She, I mean, I would never, I would, half of this stuff, or most of this stuff would never have occurred to me, yeah, but she came along with It's a Long Way to Tipperary. Again, you're talking about sort of forgotten stories of the Great War. There's a whole thing about the way that these songs were written and what happened to the people who wrote them. But yeah, she came along with It's a Long Way to Tipperary. And then threw it in a minor key later on in the show but the one that I think that really stands out, well, the two that stand out, I think, in terms of the songs are probably... there's a song called The Recruited Collier, which is, you know, what's the matter with you, my lass, and where's your dashing, Jimmy? And it's an old song about a young man who is press ganged. And it had a sort of new lease of life as a song about a young miner who is press ganged. And then what Shona Lee did was take it and give it a new lease of life as a song about a young man who's a conscientious objector. And it's sung from the point of view of his mother. And that's a point of view that I probably wouldn't have included or been able to do justice to if I was just telling the stories by myself to get the women's angle. And certainly that's true of the stories as well. There's a whole other story to be told about the women who supported the conscience.
Yeah, that's something I was going to ask you, is about, you know, having, as it were, busted these stories out of the silence, do you feel like are there more that would still excite you, that you'd still be enthusiastic to?
Yeah, you could be the rest of your life doing it, basically. Mm. You could be the rest of your life doing it. I mean, the story of the women is the one that cries out to be told. Because we're a little harsh on the suffragettes. You know, we were so shocked to discover that the suffragettes basically... They took a rather calculated decision that they couldn't afford or some of them did.
Yeah,
some
I think
of them did.
That's worth mentioning because in the show,
yeah,
you follow the official line of the, I forget the name, it's the UA, the Organisation of Women's Suffrage.
Yeah.
And you don't sort of mention that actually that was quite a divisive position.
We don't, no. That's one of the things that we had to leave out. And really, if time and money were no object, then we would love to put in more about the suffragettes because they were so absolutely, you know, the women were so absolutely essential. And the No Conscription Fellowship, most of the men in the No Conscription Fellowship were arrested because they were all themselves conscientious objectors. And the newsletter of the No Conscription Fellowship, which was called the Tribune, it never missed an issue during the whole of the war.
Wow.
And that is in the context of the fact that MI5, the fledgling intelligence services, spent the entire war trying to close the Tribune down. And they arrested Fenner Brockway, you know, the chairman of the NCF, got dragged off to prison. And there's all sorts of fun stories about what he did there because he was a very resourceful man. But basically what he couldn't do was edit the Tribune, and it was left, the offices of the NCF were left in the hands of the women, including a woman called Catherine Marshall, who was one of the suffragettes who took the pacifist line. And they played cat and mouse with the security service like you wouldn't believe. You know, it was literally the case that they had their printing presses confiscated. They couldn't do a print run. So, and the offices of the NCF were being staked out 24/7 by the intelligence services. And so there was literally a system that they evolved where Catherine Marshall would basically make up the master copy of the current edition of the Tribune. And she would roll it up. And I'm not sure, I couldn't quote the exact details, but she would pretty much wrap it in a shawl. And then a beggar woman with an empty pram would come trundling by the offices of the NCF, come up and knock on the door and ask for sixpence, and would be refused. And while she was being refused, they would slip the master copy into the pram, and she would trundle the pram away under the noses of the intelligence services, away to some secret printing press that they had squirreled away somewhere. And that way, they kept the Tribune, kept the newsletter going right the way throughout the war. It was a phenomenal estate, and the courage as well. Because the thing is, you've got to understand that the intelligence services were not playing fair on this one. There was another woman who desperately needs to have a story told. Is a woman called Alice Wheeldon, and I pretty much work. I don't quite walk past her house on my way to work every day at Derby, but it's not too far. She lived in Derby. And she was a trade unionist and a socialist. And what she did was she was one of a number of activists who ran an underground railroad for escaped conscientious objectors. She would take them in and shelter them and hide them if they were fugitive. And the security services, I think it was MI6, found out that she was doing it. And so they got some guy who was a convicted criminal, had a string of convictions, and they got him to impersonate a runaway conscientious objector and to knock on her door, and she took him in. And then he said, he basically spun her a story about wanting to organise a mass prison break for conscientious objectors, and what they would need to do would be to poison the guard dogs at this prison. So he procured strychnine and other poisons with her agreement on the basis that they were going to be used to poison the guard dogs, which didn't exist at this prison, which also didn't exist, but she didn't know that. And they basically planted the evidence on her. And when this poison had been planted on her, this guy went straight to the police and said that he'd uncovered a plot to assassinate the Prime Minister by poisoning Lloyd George. And Alice Wheeldon was done for this, and she got several years hard labour. And they rolled up her network. As it were, and after the war, she went back to Derby and she lived and worked. But she had had such harsh treatment in prison that she didn't live that long after the war. She made it through to a few years of peace, but she lived and died in Derby, and she's buried there now, not too far from the Arboretum.
Wow.
And those, I think, are, you know, they're just incredible stories, and they're absolutely, I believe, absolutely part of our heritage and part of our tradition and part of what make us as a community who we are today, and we are not told those stories.
Mm-hmm. As we sort of bring this to a close, I obviously want to plug that on the 4th of July in the White Lion in Beeston, as part of Beeston Tales, the monthly storytelling club in Beeston, and also to celebrate is the wrong word, but to remember the Great Chilwell munitions disaster. There's a whole day of storytelling events taking place in Beeston Town Square, and in the evening we've got Simon, and he'll be telling Out of the Silence there. So if you want to hear the whole piece and you're anywhere in the East Midlands, get along to Beeston on the 4th of July. But Simon, have you got anything that you want to plug?
Oh yes, several things. Yeah, it's turning into quite a busy summer. We'll be at Festival at the Edge on the 17th to the 19th of July at Stokes Barn at Much Wenlock in Shropshire. That's one of the big annual storytelling festivals. And we'll be down there doing some new work. Also, yeah, we're doing the thing at Beeston as well, as you just said. Got a couple of courses coming up. We Shanley and I teach a course on creative writing and the narrative arts that runs at the National Centre for Traditional Music at Halsey Manor in Taunton and Somerset. That's the 10th to the 14th of August this year. Those are probably the two or three big things. And also, also unrelated to any of this, there's a book coming out in the autumn of South Yorkshire folk tales, where we've basically gone and looked up all the lesser known legends of South Yorkshire and put them all in a book. And again, a similar sort of thing, very different material, but a very similar sort of principle, in that it's stuff that is there and hidden away, and people don't necessarily know it, or they don't know all of it, but if you put it all together, you suddenly end up with something that's massive and much bigger than you expect, and marvellous. So that's coming out in the autumn with the History Press. And we haven't had a definite date yet, but we're hoping to get one fairly soon.
Well, you're a very busy and a very interesting person. Thank you enormously for speaking to us today.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
It's a very busy study that we're recording in today, and there's been a few people who've sort of very quietly and conscientiously snuck in and out during the course of the recording. But I've grabbed Shona Lee while she's here with her washing up gloves on to see if she will sing one of the songs that we've been talking about.
My boy of 18 summers long was called to king and country, but he refused to raise a gun, and so they called him Conchy. Now medals won, no banners raised, no statues wreathed in season, but he fought as hard as any man for justice, hope and reason. When he refused to go to war, the generals were a-seething. They said that such a cowardly lad would leave his mother grieving. But no one ever thought to ask just what I thought about it. I saw the courage in his heart burn bright so none would doubt it. And Mrs. Pankhurst's suffragettes were worse than any other. 'Tis votes for women or your lads' lives, she called to every mother. And when my boy was sent to trial, white feathered with their fury, the verdict was already in from Hague's appointed jury. And sentenced now to live and breathe in a box of steel and mortar, while brothers, sons and husbands march in khaki to the slaughter. Forbidden to look skyward, for there's hope held in them stars. Forbidden now to breathe a word behind those prison bars. And no medals won. shoes wreathed in season. But he fought as hard as any man for justice, hope, and reason.
The Room Behind the Bookcase is created by Tim Ralphs. For music details, links, and a list of upcoming gigs, go to timralphs.com.